Not a damn thing, said Sam, he leaned back in his chair, stretching his legs. I never heard an accent like it. Say, Mikey, you know where we can get a drink around here? Oh, there's beer at the canteen, but that's all. That's a dry county, haven't you heard? Prohibition never ended in Tennessee. Damn, I could sure use a drink right now. I know what you mean. But be careful, you can get arrested if you're caught bringing liquor in through the gates. This is the honest-to-God Bible Belt. You're not in Flatbush anymore. Sam sucked at the end of the cigarette until it tasted terrible, not wanting to let it go. Grudgingly, he stubbed it out and tossed it from the window. His security clearance came through the next day, and Sam got his promised tour from Private John Bagger, who hardly looked older than 15, with a small, round face and ears too large for it. He drove Sam around in an open-top car and told him about the Manhattan Engineer District's amazing achievements in building this town out of nothing. Just 1 year ago, sir, this land was empty, except for the occasional farmer cabin. There was only one paved road on the whole reservation. Now there's a fully functioning city. They passed a few makeshift buildings that were hardly more than shanties, with sloping roofs and noticeable gaps in the walls. There's certainly a lot of dirt. Yes, sir. The construction has kicked up a lot of mud, as I'm sure you've noticed. I hope you've got a good pair of boots. Sam looked down at his once black shoes, now caked grayish-brown. We're driving on the main street of Oak Ridge, Tennessee Avenue. To our right are brand-new residential communities. You'll never get lost here because of the clever system of street names. The avenues are named alphabetically from east to west after the states of the Union. For instance, Arkansas is the easternmost, next over is California, and so on. And then any street that turns off one of the avenues has a name beginning with the same letter. A for Arkansas, C for California. Sam couldn't bear any more and cut him off. Yes, I see. That is terribly clever. Private Bagger had turned onto New York Avenue so Sam could get a better look at the homes. The yards were covered in mud, and they all looked eerily similar to one another, but not altogether awful. An effort had been made to leave some trees standing in the midst of the construction. Still, the winding cul-de-sacs and rows of identical houses had the look of children dressed up in adult clothing. They wanted to be a real neighborhood, but hadn't quite managed. You may notice that the houses all have a similar look. That's because they are prefabricated for us. We call them cementos, because they're constructed of a mixture of cement and asbestos. A new house goes up in Oak Ridge every 30 minutes. Well, that explains the noise. Sam had spent another sleepless night in the guest house. They drove down the hill, out of the cementos houses, and into a neighborhood of trailers. We have a wide range of dwellings, depending on people's position in the MED, the size of their family, and the length of their stay here. Private Bagger pointed to a barbed wire fence and gate off to the left. That's one of the prohibited areas. You have to pass through a security gate to enter the CEW from the outside, and once inside, you'll have to pass through another gate to get to the prohibited area where you work. It's very important you keep your badge with you at all times. Sam had been given a badge with his picture, a payroll number, some letters representing the restricted areas where he would be allowed to work, and the Roman numeral 4. Which gave him access to all the information about the site where he was to be working for the Tennessee Eastman Corporation, though the various other work sites were still restricted. And here on your right is the dormitory, where you'll be staying. Excuse me, did you say dormitory? Yes, sir. This is it right here. Private Bagger pulled the car up in front of a 4-story rectangular institution. There must be some mistake. I'm not supposed to be staying in a dormitory. Well, that's what it says here. The boy tapped the file beside him. I'm sure it's just temporary. With so many people coming and going, it can take a while to make housing arrangements. Private Bagger was already leaping out of the car, grabbing his suitcase, but Sam was paralyzed with rage. Please take me back to headquarters. Private Bagger's face seemed to grow even smaller with distress. I'm sorry, sir. I'm under orders to drop you off here. Sam jumped out of the car and grabbed his bag from the boy's hand. Thank you, Private. That was a very informative tour. You're welcome, sir. Hope you enjoy your time in Oak Ridge. Sam approached the front desk, explaining to the woman there that this must be a mistake, but she assured him that it was not. You're lucky, Dr. Cantor. Last week we were squeezing them in 5 to a room. He left his bag at the dormitory and walked back toward the administrative building at a quick, determined pace. Lack of sleep compounded his already acute sense of injustice. He was irrational with exhaustion, ready to take on the entire army if need be to get himself a private room for the night. He wound up back in line behind the blonde receptionist. "There's been a mistake with my housing assignment," he sputtered as soon as he reached her. She cut him off immediately. "You'll need to speak to Mr. Newman. He's in charge of housing. Down this hallway," she pointed, "third office to the left. Knock on his door and I'll let him know to expect you." He did as he was told. A hearty voice called out, "Come in."
Hello, I'm Dr. Samuel Cantor,"
he began calmly, formally, preparing to build into an impassioned rant. Mr. Newman, an imposing figure in a gray suit, half rose and extended his hand.
"Doug Newman, pleased to meet you. Have a seat."
Sam sat across from him, balancing his hat on his knee. He could hear the sound of hammering coming from the construction outside. Mr. Newman leaned back in his chair.
"So, Dr. Cantor, how can I help you?"
"There's been a mistake with my housing assignment. I've been told I'm to stay in dormitory 2 with 3 other men in my room."
"This is unacceptable."
Mr. Newman nodded sympathetically.
"I'm sorry to hear about the situation. As you can see, and hear, we are in the midst of an unprecedented building project. Now, I work for the Rowan Anderson Company. Have you heard of it?"
Sam shook his head, and Mr. Newman continued.
"We're a new company that the Army has hired to run this town."
Mr. Newman took a cigarette case out of his breast pocket, and Sam couldn't stop his eyes from widening at the sight of it.
"You smoke?"
Mr. Newman asked and held out the open case for him.
"Thank you,"
said Sam as he eagerly grabbed a cigarette.
"I haven't had a chance to buy a pack since I got here."
He felt around his pockets for a match, but Mr. Newman had already struck one and was holding it out for him. Sam met the flame with the end of his precious cigarette and inhaled deeply. Mr. Newman lit his own cigarette and leaned back again.
"So, Dr. Cantor, part of our job, our biggest job, really, is sorting out adequate housing for all of the employees here at the Clinton Engineer Works. To tell you the truth, the Army has hired more people than we have room for at the moment."
Sam tried not to be distracted by the glorious jolt of tobacco.
"Mr. Newman, I am a highly respected scientist. The government is entrusting me with resources and top-secret information. They cannot expect me to live in a dormitory like a college freshman."
"I understand your frustration, Dr. Cantor. Let me assure you that an effort will be made to rectify this. In fact,"
he began shuffling through a stack of papers on his desk,
"I have the paperwork here to assign workers to 10 new trailers, and I'm going to make sure that you are placed in one of these."
Sam remembered the depressing rings of trailers.
"Thank you, sir."
"It will probably be a week until these are up and running. Can you manage in the dormitory until then?"
Sam clenched his jaw.
"I can manage. But I want your company to know that I think it's a fine way to greet the scientists you have working here by throwing them into accommodations that are hardly better than barracks."
He stood to make his point fully dramatic, took a final drag of the lovely cigarette, and stubbed it out in Mr. Newman's ashtray.
"Thank you for the cigarette and your help."
"You're welcome, Dr. Cantor."
He stubbed out his own cigarette as Sam started out the door.
"Oh, and one last thing," said Mr. Newman, and Sam turned back. "We have better men than you, Dr. Cantor, living in Army barracks and far more godforsaken spots than Oak Ridge."
His face was still friendly, but his voice was cold. Sam walked slowly back to the dormitory, the anger and adrenaline gone, replaced by a great tiredness. It didn't matter if anyone was in the room or not when he got back. He was going to sleep. He could sleep for 2 days if he wanted. He didn't have to start work until Tuesday.
"Sam!"
he heard someone call out, and he stopped, wondering who might know him in this foreign place. He turned and saw Charlie Stone crossing the muddy street toward him, smiling and waving.
"Sam, it's so good to see you. I'd hoped you'd make it out this way."
Charlie patted him on the back, and Sam shook his hand heartily.
"Sure is good to see a friendly face."
"When did you get here?"
"Just 2 days ago. Is this place as awful as it seems?"
Charlie laughed.
"It grows on you."
Sam looked skeptical.
"Truly, you'll see. There's a certain charm to frontier living. Say, can I get you a cup of coffee? I was just headed to the canteen."
Charlie led him to a cafeteria near the town site.
The two men had been friends in graduate school at Princeton in the 30s. Charlie had been the nicest guy in the physics department. The cafeteria was bustling, and the strong aroma of bacon alerted Sam to the fact that he was hungry. "They serve breakfast all day here, and the place is open 24 hours to accommodate all the different shifts," explained Charlie. Sam got a plateful of eggs, bacon, and biscuits the likes of which he'd never seen before. They were dense yet fluffy, dripping with butter. He crunched into the bacon with the unavoidable guilt that came from disappointing his mother, but it passed quickly. Charlie sat across from him with a cup of coffee and a tuna sandwich. "How long's it been?" "The last time I saw you was back in Princeton. In what, 39? "That sounds right. How have you been? How's Anne?" Anne was Charlie's wife, a thin but pretty girl from old Boston money. "We're well. Moving here has been a challenge for her. But listen, Sam, could you do us a huge favor?"
"What?"
Sam asked through a gluttonous mouthful of eggs. "Would you move into a house with us? We're on a waiting list to get one, and since we don't have children, it would help if we had a boarder." Sam swallowed and looked up.
"Are you serious? I'm supposed to be living in a trailer. Of course, I'd be thrilled." "Are you sure it would be all right?"
"Yes, yes, you'd be doing us a favor. Really, I don't know how long it will take us to get a house otherwise."
"Well, if Anne will have me, I'll do it."
"Anne will be delighted."
"You've made my day, Charlie."
"Wonderful. Then it's all settled. So what took you so long to get here, Cantor?"
"Security clearance took forever."
"I see. And that wouldn't have anything to do with past bad behavior."
"Who knows? Well, they interviewed every member of my family they could get their hands on. Scared my poor aunt half to death.
She thought I'd become a spy. Apparently it's very suspicious to U.S. Army intelligence that I have so many relatives in Germany. Never mind, of course, that all those relations have either fled or disappeared." Charlie nodded solemnly.
"Well, thank goodness you're here now. We could use you." "Is there anyone else here we know?"
"Will Kellerman's here. Some other names you'd probably recognize, but none of the old gang."
"Most are in New Mexico, I guess."
Charlie shook his head and whispered, "Not here." In a normal voice, he said, "I wouldn't know." His friendly eyes widened meaningfully. He looked down at the table and picked up Sam's battered hat. Its edges were frayed and the top drooped pathetically.
"I know there's a war on, but can we get you a new hat?"
Sam smiled.
"I'll see what I can do."
He gathered the remainders of eggs and biscuit crumbs up onto his fork and shoved them into his mouth. Chapter 3. Despite the fact that he was wearing almost all the clothes he owned and was further wrapped in two blankets, Joe was cold. Each breath he took sent icy air tearing into his nose and chest. The wood stove in the middle of the room couldn't combat the wind ripping through the plywood walls of the hutment, nor could the thin flannel blankets. The door opened, and a blast of air assaulted him. It was Ralph, finally coming home from the rec hall. Joe watched him walk to the cot to take off his boots. As he started to take off his jacket, Joe whispered,
"Ain't no point. You're gonna need that on to get through this night." "I'm hot."
Ralph hung the jacket on a clothesline strung up across the room.
"You're crazy."
Joe rolled over in his cot to face the wall, the weak heat from the stove now on his back. Sometimes it was no use talking sense to Ralph. Still, the boy was his only real friend here at Oak Ridge. At least the only person he'd known long enough to trust. They'd come up from Alabama together a year and a half ago to work in a labor gang. Now they shared a hutment with three other men. The plywood box could hardly be called a house. It was 16 feet by 16 feet, and their cots and chairs filled the room right up. There were no windows, just pieces of wood on a hinge you could open in summer. It had been hot when they arrived in July, hotter than Alabama, if that was even possible. The colored hutments were built on the lowest point of land in Oak Ridge, a swamp overridden with mosquitoes. They had to keep the windows open at night, and the mosquitoes were as much residents of the place as he and the other workers living there. Those first nights had been sleepless, too, but it was because he couldn't stop sweating or scratching the great pink welts on his legs and arms. Joe tried to remember that heat, the awful insects humming above his head,
and wondered if it was worse than this November cold. But summer seemed like a dream, impossible to recapture. At least now he'd gotten used to things. Those first months he had thought he wouldn't be able to stand being away from his wife, Mariah. On those sleepless, sweltering nights, he'd had half a mind to walk right out of the wretched hutment and hitch a ride down to Alabama, where Mariah and the children were waiting. Now he knew he could stand it a little longer, make more money, get Mariah up here just as soon as possible. $38 a week, weather permitting. That was what had brought him here in the first place, and that was the reason he stayed. They got 57.5 cents per hour for 40 hours, 86.25 cents per hour for overtime, and as long as it didn't storm, he could work 18 hours overtime. Joe had always been a hard worker. He was 6'2" with strong, long arms, toughened by years of work, and was proud of his ability to provide for his family. That was all a man needed, really, and it kept him out of trouble. The labor gangs were working on huge buildings, bigger by far than anything Joe had ever seen. Whatever it was the army was building here, it sure made an impression. He didn't have any experience doing construction, but was a fast learner. These days, the foreman had him mixing and pouring concrete, endless amounts of the stuff. By the end of the day, every muscle in his body called for a reprieve. His back ached, and his shoulders felt pinched with pain. But he'd never been one to complain about hard work. What bothered him most about the job was the landscape. He missed the country. He felt as though he might as well be on Mars looking around at the sprawling mass of beams and frames and half-finished factories. Steel, concrete, men in hard hats, and mud as far as he could see in any direction. It oppressed him. It was unnatural and ungodly, and he missed the fields, the trees, birdsong, and animal noises, rather than the relentless hammering, drilling, and rumbling of engines. When he wasn't working, he kept to himself or palled around with Ralph. They got plenty of food in the colored cafeteria, though you had to be sure to get there before they quit serving. There were always two choices, not spicy, or spicy for the folks from Louisiana who liked that sort of thing. He'd tried the spicy food once, but it just burned his mouth. The not spicy food kept his belly full, but what he wouldn't give for some of Mariah's fried okra and collard greens. He wrote to her and the children every day as best he could, though his spelling wasn't good. He'd never got past the fourth grade in school and knew he got things wrong, but he had to stay connected to them, and in return they each sent him little notes and drawings. He kept them all, neatly folded in his footlocker, under the cot. He put everything of value he owned, which wasn't much, in the locker, because there was no lock on the hutment. Be charitable to all men, but don't trust any of them, his father had always said. He went to church regularly, though he made it a point to stay away from the holy rollers in town. Joe had always taken his spirituality seriously and never trusted fanatics, the roadside prophets too easily overcome by the Holy Spirit, and there were plenty of that type here in Oak Ridge. Ralph still came to church with him, but the boys seemed to seek out trouble. Ralph had always been hot-tempered. He'd shown up one day about 5 years back on the Hopewell farm, couldn't have been older than 14, with the nastiest broken arm Joe had ever seen. Said he was looking for work, but he could hardly stand with the pain in his arm. Joe figured he must have been running from trouble, but something in the boy's firmly set lips moved him. He brought Ralph home, and Mariah took care of him, setting his arm in a splint. It was never quite right, but he was strong and made up for it with his good arm. Ralph went to church with them and became a favorite because of his strong tenor. Reverend Clayton said Ralph had the sort of voice that brought sinners back to God. He still didn't drink or gamble, at least not that Joe knew about, and that was saying something in this place. Wasn't much else to do, and the rec halls were filled with illegal hooch and poker games. Joe stayed away from that stuff, but occasionally he went with Ralph to the rec hall. It was little more than a barn. Sometimes a screen was pulled down to show race films. Other times he played checkers with Ralph or the other men, but he always kept an eye out and made sure both of them got out of there if things turned rowdy. Just last week, a man had been stabbed in the hutment next door over a $5 gambling debt. Folks had too much time on their hands. That, and they weren't allowed to live with their women, which stirred up trouble. In any case, it wasn't drinking or gambling that worried Joe about the boy. Ralph's real problem was his temper.
After a year, he finally told Joe why he wound up on the Hopewell farm. His stepfather had been hitting Ralph's mother until the boy got in the middle. He'd beaten the man badly and hadn't waited to see what shape he'd be in when he regained consciousness.
"Joe," Ralph whispered, "you awake?"
"No, sir. I'm dreaming of a furnace."
"It ain't right."
"What?"
"This ain't no fit place for a man to live. We were better off working in the fields.
We could hardly feed ourselves.
At least we ain't have to answer to no one but Mr. Hopewell.
Here, we've got the whole army against us. It won't last forever, Ralph. War will end someday. At least you ain't fighting."
Ralph had tried to enlist, but the army wouldn't take him on account of his arm. Sometimes Joe thought the boy would have been better off serving with all that fight inside of him. But selfishly, he was glad Ralph was here. Even though he was just a boy, he was a good friend. Hot-headed, yes, but Joe knew if he or Mariah were in any kind of trouble, Ralph would be the first person there to help them. Ralph rolled over, away from him. The boy got big ideas from the colored newspapers his friends in the rec hall gave him. Sometimes he'd read them aloud to Joe. He read haltingly, belying his lack of education, but far better than Joe could read to himself. Last summer, the papers had stories about Negroes rioting in cities and often getting killed. Ralph would get too worked up reading about it to keep his voice steady and finally would put the paper down to go outside and walk or smoke. Ralph wore a double V pin on his jacket, which he'd ordered from the Pittsburgh Courier. The two V's stood for double victory, democracy at home and abroad. Joe told him it would only draw attention to him, but Ralph just laughed in a bitter way and said white folks wouldn't know what it meant anyway. Joe didn't worry too much about the things Ralph said. He was just a kid, after all. Didn't have the same worries Joe did, trying to feed three children. Joe was 48 and had worked for Mr. Hopewell as long as he could remember. This was his first time out of Alabama, and sometimes he missed the red dirt of the farm so much that he felt his chest tighten. Strange, because he'd always cursed that piece of land where he had been born and stuck his whole life. But it was home, and miss it he did, just as he missed the little cabin where he had grown up and where his own children had been born. Shabby as it was a real house, suitable for a family. Mariah would be in the wooden bed at the back now, asleep under one of her quilts with little Ben in her arms. The girls would be sleeping in their bed across the room, the only time they were ever quiet. If he had been there, he would kiss their soft cheeks, tiptoe over to his bed, and slide in behind Mariah and Ben, wrapping her in his arms. If it was cold in the cabin, they would keep each other warm. If he was feeling hopeless, she would put her warm hand on his cheek, talk to him in her rich, soothing voice until he was calm. In a moment, Joe was asleep, still shivering, but dreaming of Mariah. Then, before he knew it, the alarm was ringing, a harsh, tinny sound. At home in Alabama, Joe would wake up naturally at dawn with the sun's rising and the roosters crowing. It wasn't like he'd enjoyed waking up so much back then, but it was more peaceful than greeting the day in this plywood box with that awful little clock blaring at him. It was his and Ralph's week on the early shift. The other men in the room stayed still or groaned or rolled their heads under their pillows. Joe silenced the alarm and swung his legs over the side of the cot. He went over to a wash basin and braced himself for the touch of icy water. The joints in his fingers ached as he slid his hands into the bowl and splashed his face as quickly as possible. That woke a man up. He and Ralph would get breakfast in the cafeteria, then head to their gang. Joe looked forward to breakfast, mostly because the cafeteria was well heated and he would be comfortable for the first time in 12 hours. Then it was back out into the cold to work, but labor kept the body warm. Ralph was still in bed. Joe gave his shoulder a squeeze.
"Ralph,"
he said in a loud whisper, trying not to disturb his roommates. Ralph didn't respond, and Joe shook him hard.
"Wake up, boy."
Ralph let out a little moan and rolled over. Half asleep like this, he looked like a child.
"Come on," Joe whispered more gently. "Let's get some coffee and grits in you, and you'll feel better."
Ralph didn't say a word on the way to the cafeteria.
"You shouldn't stay out so late,"
chided Joe. Ralph hunched into his jacket, hands dug deep into the side pockets. The sun was just rising up over the ridge in front of them, bright but now warm. Joe watched his breath cloud in front of his mouth as he spoke.
"Gotta take care of yourself, Ralph."
Ralph sighed.
"Yes, sir, I hear."
Joe doubted his lectures ever did much good, but he suspected the boy appreciated them, despite his surly attitude. Ralph's daddy had never been around, and his stepfather had obviously been no account. The colored cafeteria was crowded, with all the men on the early shift filling up for the morning's work ahead of them. Sure enough, the room was sweltering with radiator heat and the crowd of bodies. It was loud, too. The walls echoed with conversations, laughter, even a harmonica coming from somewhere. Too much noise for that time of the morning. They got platefuls of biscuits and gravy and mugs of black coffee, not real coffee, but an earthy-tasting substitute. It was hot, at least, as were the biscuits, even if they were dry and crumbled at the touch. The gravy was thin, with only a couple of puny pieces of sausage bobbing in it, but the food would keep them going until their next meal in 5 hours. Ralph gulped down the fake coffee, but only picked at his biscuit.
"Aren't you hungry?" asked Joe.
He shrugged. At times like this, Joe wanted to shake some sense into him. Why was he always so sullen, making himself so miserable? If a man puts a plate of hot food in front of you, you eat it. Simple as that.
"You ain't sick, is you?"
"No, I ain't sick." Ralph took a big bite. You just had to nudge him like a child.
"Got a letter from Mariah yesterday. Ben learned to say daddy when she showed him my letters."
Ralph had a soft spot for the children. He almost smiled.
"Where were you last night, anyhow?"
"Rec hall."
"Playing checkers?"
Ralph shook his head.
"Talking."
He leaned into Joe and spoke in a low voice.
"Some men here got real big ideas."
"What sort of ideas?"
"Ideas about how we can change things."
Ralph leaned back as though to let that sink in. Joe was suspicious of this sort of talk.
"You getting into trouble?"
"No, sir."
Ralph stabbed some biscuit and shoved it into his mouth.
"It's not like that. These are good folks who think we deserve to be treated better for helping our country fight this war."
A bell went off, which meant it was 6:50, time for the men to go meet their crews. Everyone began getting up, the room loud with the sounds of trays being slammed down and chairs sliding against the rough floor. Ralph stood, and Joe followed.
"Just be careful," said Joe.
He couldn't help but sound disapproving. They would be pouring concrete that morning, laying the foundation for yet another new building. He and Ralph met the rest of their gang, and they were all loaded into the back of a bus to drive across the reservation to the site. The buildings being built were giants. For the life of him, Joe couldn't work out what in the world the army would do with such monstrosities. He looked out over what had been fields and farmland when he first arrived, familiar and so much more fathomable to him than these warehouses, factories, and endless parking lots. Plenty of folks would no doubt marvel at the sight of a city being built practically overnight. It did give you a sense of man's capabilities. Maybe that was what got Ralph so riled up about this place. For a young man, Joe reckoned, it would be hard to look around without thinking about what was possible, what men could accomplish, and what a man could do for himself. The spot where they'd been working all week was at the bottom of a steep valley. It was as though they were filling the valley right up with their construction. He was glad to have a chance to do his part for the war effort, not because of patriotic feelings exactly, but more because he knew so many young men who were off fighting, boys from his church back in Alabama, and some of the other field hands from the Hopewell farm. Even young Teddy Hopewell had died in Italy. Mariah had written to Joe after Teddy's death, distraught. She'd looked after him as a child. Once he was working, Joe's mind wandered less. He became focused on the task at hand, which was a relief because it took his mind off the missing. Missing Mariah, missing the children, missing the country. The morning would pass by quickly enough this way, and soon enough another day would be gone. He'd be exhausted, but one day closer to having enough money to send for his family. Chapter 4. For C.C. Roberts, the war had been an opportunity. An international crisis disruptive enough for her to undergo a personal transformation. In 1942, she had been a sharecropper's daughter, beautiful, but with a bleak future of poverty, hard work, and harder religion in front of her. A year later, she had run off to Nashville with a boy she knew from grade school who had just enlisted. He wanted to marry her, but as soon as she got to town, she found a room to share with another girl and a job as a hostess at a hotel restaurant downtown. She was hired because she was pretty, and the rich ladies who came to dine there liked to be surrounded by pretty things. She listened carefully to them and their debutante daughters. As Cece seated them at perfectly set tables, she absorbed the way they held themselves, the formation of their vowel sounds. At night, she would lock herself in the hallway bathroom at her rooming house and practice talking like those Nashville ladies. By the time she heard about Oak Ridge, her transformation was almost complete. No one ever had to know that her daddy was a sharecropper. She spoke and carried herself like a plantation heiress. What Cece lacked, of course, was actual money, but she recognized a prospect to fix that at the Clinton Engineer Works. Cece loved everything about Oak Ridge. She didn't even mind the mud. She could be whomever she pleased in this strange new town full of people passing through. People from all over who didn't know anything about her or care where she came from. She loved the boys and the parties and the dancing. She loved roller skating and listening to records and how everything here was different from Perry County. She had to be careful with the boys. It was fun to flirt and be admired, but she always kept her ultimate goal in mind, finding a husband with money. So many girls got swept away at the sight of a uniform, but just because a man was a hotshot in the Army now didn't mean he'd amount to squat when the war was over. Wars can't last forever, and you had to think long term. It was lovely to be making 75 cents an hour, but it wasn't enough. Cece had glimpsed what life was like for the truly wealthy and saw no reason why it shouldn't be like that for her, too. Her mother had always told her that working hard would get her anything she wanted. But her hard-working mother's body was worn out at 40, and her mother's future held nothing but more work. Cece wasn't going to waste her life working hard. She would use the gifts God had given her, her striking good looks, and see that they secured her a future with as little work in it as possible. She made sure to tell everyone she could that she was here to do her part for the war effort, which she carefully implied was that she had no need for the money she made working in the factory. Her time and energy were being donated as an act of charity. One of the most important lessons she learned in Nashville was that money, or at least the illusion of money, attracted more money. Cece asked the right questions of her suitors, subtly did her research. You had to find out his plans, what kind of family he was from. She carefully strung along as many boys as possible at a time, giving each just enough attention to keep him wanting more, but not so much that he would get the wrong idea. You couldn't let them get too far. It was important to have a sterling reputation so that when you found the right one, he would marry you. Of course, there were older men at Oak Ridge, too, men who already had money. But Cece found that pursuing those types was tricky. They didn't tend to socialize with the young people at the dances and the bowling alley. Besides, most of them were married, and if they weren't, you had to wonder why not. She'd gone on one date with the bald engineer who spent the whole time telling her about his three beloved pet turtles he'd had to leave back in Pennsylvania with his mother. He hadn't tried to kiss her or even hold her hand once all night, which was just as well. She had meant it when she told June that they'd be best friends. Her new roommate seemed sweet, and to tell the truth, Cece needed a friend. She'd never been good with other girls. Boys she knew how to talk to, but girls always seemed jealous. Or maybe it was because she could be a little mean. She was competitive when it came to men, but you had to be, especially in times like these when there were hardly any of them to go around. But June was perfect. She was mourning a dead fiancé, and plain and shy, anyway. Cece was feeling happy and charitable. Things were going so well for her in Oak Ridge that she ought to share her happiness by reaching out to help this new girl. She could have nothing to do with the other roommate, Lisbeth, however. It was such a horrible coincidence. She'd recognize the girl as soon as they met. Lisbeth had lived a town over from Cece growing up, and she remembered her from summer revivals. Lisbeth had never let on that she recognized Cece, so it was quite possible she didn't remember. Still, it made Cece nervous. She told everyone she met here that she was from Nashville, and Lisbeth might figure out the truth.
Cece tried to stay away from her and always treated her coldly. She felt bad about this, but it couldn't be helped. Besides, everyone over in Lewis County was trash. Luckily, Lisbeth didn't spend much time in the dorm. Cece usually had the room all to herself when she got home from work. Today, though, June was there, eagerly waiting for her, like a little dog.
"Hi, Cece," June called out as she came through the door. "I'm so glad you're home. I've been dying to talk to someone all day."
Cece began peeling off her boots.
"The work's pretty boring, huh? I thought I was going to lose my mind. What do you do to make the time go by?"
"I don't know," said Cece as she sat down on the bed.
"Think about what I'm going to do when I get off work, I guess." "Do you want to go get some dinner?" June asked. "Yes, just give me a minute to put myself together."
Cece had put a small mirror on the wall over the dresser the girl shared. She went to it now and examined her face to determine what needed to be done. Powder, definitely. The wintry weather was turning her face red.
A bit of eyeshadow, but not too much. She wanted to look polished, not garish. And lipstick, always.
June was chatty all through dinner. She talked about her family back on their farm and all the mud and dust in town and how many choices there were in the cafeteria. She ate as she talked, wolfing down macaroni and cheese. Cece was surprised to see such a skinny girl eat so much. Some girls are just lucky, she supposed. Though, really, June was too thin, scrawny, like a tomboy, and she had hardly any bust. Cece was lucky in that department. She had a full bosom, a tiny waist, and long, long legs. When they finished eating, Cece suggested they go bowling. June giggled.
"I've never been bowling." "Oh, June, that's so cute. You're such a sweet country girl."
Of course, Cece had never been bowling before she moved to Nashville, either. All the way to the bowling alley, June kept talking.
"So, do you work at the same kind of machine as me? Turning the knobs and watching the meters?"
"Yeah, don't worry. You get used to it."
"Do you ever wonder what the machines are doing?"
"June, it's not safe to talk about that kind of thing." Cece looked around to make sure no one could hear them.
"No one's around. Don't you wonder?"
"No. And you shouldn't wonder either." Finally, June was quiet. The bowling alley was crowded, and Cece looked for boys they could play against. Bowling was an excellent chance to show off your figure while acting helpless, troubled by the heavy ball, confused by the score pad. Of course, June really was troubled and confused by it all. She looked a bit stunned by the noise and commotion. Cece went first and showed her how to hold a ball. But June's first attempt wound up in the gutter, and her second, third, and fourth. She was getting discouraged, and Cece was getting bored, when a group of four soldiers took the lane beside them. June sent her fifth ball immediately into the gutter and trudged back to try again. Cece saw the boys looking over at them. June plopped the ball right into the gutter again and gave Cece a miserable look. Cece went to the front of the lane and stood up straight with the ball in front of her, chest forward, head high. She didn't have to turn around to know that at least one of the soldiers was taking a good look. Gracefully pulling her arm back, she released the ball. Five pins went down. As Cece waited for her ball, she told June, "Don't worry, you'll get the hang of it. It just takes practice, is all." Then she scored a spare. June clapped for her politely, then got up to face failure once again. As she walked forward, Cece turned around toward the soldiers, who were still setting up and lacing their shoes.
"Say," she said loudly, and all four of them turned. "I don't suppose any of you could help my friend? It's her first time bowling, and I think she needs a good lesson."
They all scrambled to speak at once.
"I could show her. I've been bowling for years. Anything for you. Gorgeous."
Cece smiled graciously.
"Why don't we all play together?" she asked.
By the time June came back to sit down, their game was over, and Cece had moved into the boys' lane. Two of the boys were demonstrating their bowling technique to June, while the other two were staring at Cece.
"Poor thing," she said, watching her friend, and in a loud whisper continued, "She just lost a fella overseas."
She hoped this would quickly circulate through all four soldiers while she made up her mind which one to go after. The two boys nodded solemnly and gave June sympathetic looks when she came back to sit down again. By the end of the evening, June had learned to bowl, and Cece had made a date for Saturday night with the best-looking soldier of the group. June had an alarm clock, but her eyes flipped open automatically anyway at 6:29.
She blinked in the darkness. She'd been dreaming about work, the meters and the dials. But there was something else in her dream that gave her an uneasy feeling. She tried to recapture the images before she was too awake to remember. She'd been in Y-12, on her stool, turning the knobs, but someone else had been there too. Ronnie. It came back to her in a flash, and she wished she hadn't remembered after all. Ronnie had been alive and talking to her, trying to distract her from her work, teasing her like he always did. Ronnie was gone, she thought. How far gone? She questioned the darkness around her. Gone, echoed the dark corners of the room. He is dead, and you didn't love him. And she knew then that this thought had lodged in her brain and would come up again and again for the rest of the day. The problem with the work was the monotony. She tried to force her thoughts in positive directions, but it was a struggle, with no distractions, nothing to focus on. She tried to plan a birthday present for her mother, or imagine a radio drama in her mind. A wealthy New York socialite on a pleasure safari in darkest Africa is separated from her much older husband and the rest of her party, save for the rough and worldly adventurer who's been leading them through the jungle. How are they separated? Perhaps a lion attacked their camp in the night. She saw blood and bones, ripped shreds of clothing, and winced, not wishing such a gruesome fate on the socialite's dull but kind husband. Maybe a tribe of cannibals captured the lady and the adventurer, though of course he would arrange for their escape in no time. Coming up with details helped kill the time. On the evening of the capture, the socialite would be wearing a smart khaki suit with a wide collar and pleated skirt. She was an icy blonde with blue eyes. The adventurer was dark, of course, strong and wild-eyed. Clark Gable. The radio drama, now a cinema spectacular. The cannibals were dancing and chanting around the two of them who had been tied to a tree, but Clark had already managed to undo the knots and the ropes binding their hands. Then it was lunchtime, and June let the blessed respite of conversation, giggling, and gossip wash over her. By evening, the socialite and Clark Gable would be making love on a steamer bound for New York, the husband having conveniently succumbed to an unidentified tropical disease as they'd made their way through the jungle. Much more humane than death as a lion's dinner, June thought. By June's fourth week at work, she barely registered the meters at all. She kept her eyes on them constantly, and somehow her mind identified where they were pointing, but it had become subconscious, turning the knobs, an automatic reflex. She got into a routine. The first few hours would be interminably long, and she'd alternate between making up grand stories of adventure and counting the minutes, happily marking the hours as they passed, eagerly calculating when she had made it halfway to lunch, two-thirds of the way to the end of the day. Lunch would refresh her spirits, and every day when she left, she'd feel a great surge of relief, as well as the smaller, dull dread of having to do it all again tomorrow. Not that it was always boring. Occasionally, the machines would start going haywire, the meters flipping back and forth wildly. Her mind would snap back into focus, her daydreams ending abruptly, and she'd have to devote herself to keeping the controls steady. Sometimes this lasted for hours. They had been told not to wear hairpins, and on June's third day, it became obvious why. One girl had forgotten, and when she sat down at her cubicle, the pins actually flew out of her hair. She began screaming, and Miss Collins rushed over and told her to hush. "Everyone get to work," she growled as the girl whimpered. A thought occurred to June that day. Magnets. Her mother had a jewelry box with a magnetic lid, and June had played with it as a child. The way the lid grabbed a needle from her fingers was not unlike how the machine yanked out the girl's hairpin. It was like they were dealing with giant magnets. In less hectic moments, it was a struggle not only to keep her thoughts in line, but sometimes just to stay awake. She frequently let Cece talk her into staying out too late at dances and could never sleep quite through the night in their little dorm room. If the sounds of the other girls didn't keep her awake, the sounds of the town would. Some nights she could hear construction noises off in the distance, and every night she could hear the roller rink, which was just next door. Since people worked around the clock, everything in Oak Ridge was open 24 hours, including the roller rink. As she stared at the meters after a sleepless night, her eyelids would feel heavy and begin to drop over her eyes. She would open them as wide as she could and stare straight ahead until they started drooping again. At all costs, she had to avoid letting her head nod. If Miss Collins saw that, she'd be in hot water for sure. But as the days passed, work became more bearable. Time didn't seem to drag as much the more time went by. The girls became less shy around each other, and before and after work they talked and laughed like old friends. Most of them were local girls like June, and this was their first time away from home. Sally, a plump redhead with rosy cheeks, was stationed at the next cubicle down from June, and they usually sat together at lunch. It was a casual friendship. Sally loved to laugh and gossip. Before June had even figured out who the other girls were, Sally was already filling her in on their backgrounds and love lives. When it came to her own love life, Sally was shy, and June suspected that she'd never had a boyfriend. The girls ignored the training talk they'd been given in the bullpen and flirted whenever a male was present. There were usually engineers and scientists in the lunchroom, and though they kept to their own tables, the more outgoing girls always found a way to strike up conversations. June and Sally stayed in the corner, far away from the action, and free to observe. June was developing a deep respect for Cece's talents as she watched these less skilled young ladies bat their eyes and giggle in such an obvious way. Cece somehow never looked like she was the one pursuing a conversation, even if June knew Cece'd had her eye on a fellow. She always made it seem like he was the one seeking her out. Compared to her, the girls at work overdid it and looked desperate. Not that the men seemed to mind. For the most part, they delighted in the female attention. "Afternoon, Dr. Thomas," Mary Lee, one of the worst of the flirts, would say to the same tall engineer every day at lunch. Her smile showed off badly crooked teeth, but he didn't seem to mind.
"How are you today, Mary Lee?"
"Not too bad, I reckon. You saved me a spot over there."
Every day, he saved her a spot, and she slid beside him on the end of a table filled with his colleagues. They watched her with bemused smiles, nudging one another, chuckling.
"Oh, I'm getting awful thirsty," Mary Lee said one day. "Can I have a sip of your Coca-Cola?"
Dr. Thomas slid the bottle over to her. She leaned over the table, pursed her lips on the straw, and sucked in an over-the-top way so that her cheeks became hollow. When she removed her mouth, the straw was painted in blood-red lipstick. June watched from the line. She walked quickly past their table with her tray to find Sally, and as she did, she noticed for the first time that Dr. Thomas was wearing a wedding ring. Not all men responded to the likes of Mary Lee. Some of the older married men kept to themselves, away from the girls. One man in particular always stayed alone, the same dark-haired scientist June had noticed on her first day. She often saw him in the corridors or the lunchroom and had overheard someone call him Dr. Cantor. He seemed important, or maybe it just looked that way because of how he always ate alone, apart from his nudging, chuckling colleagues. No girls ever bothered flirting with him, though he was handsome in a thin, disheveled way. But something in his demeanor signaled that he was too serious for flirting, and they would only be wasting their time. June would watch him eat a tuna sandwich quickly with determination, as though, like someone out of a propaganda poster, he couldn't wait to get back to his work. He must be very smart and well-educated. She wondered if he had a girlfriend and where he was from. What did a man like him do when his shift was over? Surely he didn't go bowling or to the roller rink. It was even hard to imagine someone so somber at the cinema, but then again, everyone went to the pictures, didn't they? What would it be like to run into him outside of the cavernous factory? He would never speak to her. Why would a man like that ever speak to her? Why was she even thinking about it? Even though work was getting better, come the end of her shift, June was always ready to leave. Her main objective when she was outside of Y-12 was to try to forget about the place until the next day, and her favorite method of forgetting was the movies. She had been to the cinema only a handful of times as a child. The fact that she could go whenever she wanted in Oak Ridge was thrilling. As soon as a new picture arrived at the cinema, June had to see it. Even when the movie wasn't very good, she was happy to be there. She loved everything about the experience. A big marquee over the theater read Ridge Theater, perfect pictures for particular people. She would settle into the velvet seats and enveloping darkness and get lost in the flicker of images on the screen, the beautiful stars and their beautiful gowns, the dancing or shooting, depending on whether it was a musical or a western. Most of all, she loved not having to think about dials, meters,
War. Or Ronnie. Cece didn't share June's enthusiasm for the cinema. She preferred dances, bowling, roller skating, any activity which could be combined with flirting. June didn't mind. She liked to be alone at the movies. Besides, most nights she accompanied Cece anyway, except for when her roommate had dates. June liked the dances more than she had expected. There was a heady excitement to being in a room with so many young people, listening to fast-paced swing music. Cece was always fun, full of energy, jitterbugging, bringing over boys. They were always nice to June, but clearly more interested in Cece. But June's feelings weren't hurt. It was a relief to not have to worry about flirting, which she didn't know how to do anyway. Occasionally a boy would ask her to dance, and she found it wasn't as scary as she'd initially thought. Most of them would lead her along, spinning her once in a while, smiling when she went off in the wrong direction, and she always wound up laughing. Besides, the music was so infectious that she couldn't help but move in time to the rhythm. Almost every evening was occupied by such parties or movies, and June enjoyed the constant motion of it. Cece had a strict regimen for attending dances, which she tried to teach to June. It was essential, she said, to bring a nice pair of shoes to change into out of your boots once you got to the dance. June still only had one pair of shoes and was planning to spend her first paycheck on desperately needed boots to contend with the Oak Ridge mud. Cece, meanwhile, confided that she had saved up 2 weeks' worth of salary to purchase her collection of makeup, perfume, nail polish, and curlers. She would spend a good 15 minutes applying makeup before she went out, which June found incredible since Cece was so naturally good-looking. She said as much to Cece one evening, and her roommate laughed. "You may think I'm beautiful, but this takes work." The bulk of Cece's admirers were soldiers stationed here in Oak Ridge, so there was no fear of them having to go overseas, at least for the time being. Cece didn't seem to spend much time with any one of them. She was always searching for someone better. The only one so far who had made an impression on June was a soldier named Bob. He'd brought Cece a Hershey bar when he took her out, which she later gave 2/3 of to June because she said she didn't want to lose her figure. June devoured the chocolate, which only soldiers could get their hands on these days, and thought to herself that if she were Cece, she'd seriously consider marrying the man. Other than going to the movies or dances with Cece, June spent most of her free time in lines. The lines that stretched along the boardwalks at Williams Drugstore and the A&P were more like huge human chains, the likes of which she had never seen before. Of course, once you got in the store, there was no guarantee that they would have what you wanted to buy. Because of the rationing, Oak Ridge couldn't keep enough products for its booming population. June then had to stand in another line to drop off her laundry, which Cece warned her would take a week to get back. June would rather have just done her own laundry, but she would have to use the sink in the dormitory bathroom, which was tiny. Besides, there was another line of girls waiting to use it. The cafeterias had lines, too, especially when shifts changed and everyone in town headed for supper at the same time. Cece complained about the food, but June was in awe of the different choices she could have every night of the week. She'd never eaten spaghetti before, and delighted in twirling the strands around her fork and slurping down the red sauce. On Sundays, church services were held all day long in Oak Ridge. One week, she had the wild idea of not going. It was such a strange feeling to know that she didn't have to go to church. No one was here to make her or look down on her if she didn't. But it was sinful to take such pleasure in the idea of missing church, so she went to the chapel on the hill, which held worship for many different faiths. When she got there, a Lutheran service was beginning. She was going to leave, but the usher insisted that all Christians were welcome. Afraid to seem rude, she stayed and sat in the back of the chapel. At first, the service was mostly familiar Bible passages and prayers, but then it came time to take communion. June froze in her seat, unsure of what to do. The congregation was going up row by row and kneeling at the front of the chapel, and they all seemed to know the procedure. As the usher approached her row, June panicked and bowed her head in prayer, pretending not to see him. At the end of the service, June slipped out quickly to make her way home to the dorm and Cece, and probably another dance at the canteen. She wearily thought of the rut she was in. Picking up Cece to go to the cafeteria, setting her alarm and getting up in the morning, sitting at her cubicle, staring at the meters, the war continuing on and on. Ronnie, still gone, still dead. It wasn't that this was a bad life. Her job was fine, and so was the town. But sometimes the same walks and bus rides every day, the same thoughts going through her head, their routine of doing her hair, making the bed. Sometimes it just felt unbearable. She knew she had nothing to complain about, really, so she felt guilty for feeling as she did, but if she was honest with herself, though she didn't think she was unhappy, she couldn't quite say she was happy, either. As soon as she got home, June noticed that Cece was acting strange. She was sitting in front of her mirror, but not applying any makeup or doing her hair, just staring absently at her face. "Do you have a date tonight?" asked June, trying to sound cheerful. "No." Cece didn't look away from the mirror. June laid her pocketbook on her bed and sat. "Do you want to go to the canteen later?" Cece turned away from the mirror slowly to face June. "I don't think so. I feel tired. Do you mind?" June actually felt relieved. "No, that's fine. Maybe I'll go to the cinema. Or is it too late? Or maybe we could just go for a walk or something. Would you mind that terribly? I don't feel like being alone tonight." It was surprising to see Cece this way. She was usually so controlled, so put together, like a picture of a lady in a magazine. Hardly real. They walked along the boardwalks, past the canteen and rec hall where they usually went to dance. Even though it was after midnight, there were still people out in the streets, others like June and Cece, just getting off the evening shift. A sliver of moon shone from behind the clouds, and June shivered in the cold night air. It was winter now, and Christmas was just a week off. "You think it's safe to walk around at night like this?" asked Cece.
"I reckon so. Lots of folks are out and about."
"Did you hear about that girl in Lafayette Hall? They said she was murdered."
"What?"
"The girls at work told me about it. Her boyfriend strangled her. My friend Jill was in the room right next door when it happened."
"That's awful."
June was taken aback, but she wondered if this was true or just gossip.
"How'd he get into the dorm?"
"Must have slipped past the front desk. Worst part of it, security took away her body, and they haven't told anyone what happened. It's like she never existed. She just disappeared." They walked along the boardwalk in silence for a moment, past trailers stretching on as far as the eye could see in either direction. "Do you ever think about dying?" Cece stopped in front of a small patch of woods left standing between the trailer park and a housing subdivision.
"Sure. I think about Ronnie a lot. I wonder where he is and if I'll ever see him again."
Cece nodded, but her gaze was fixed on the trees in front of her.
"You heard the news from Europe?"
"Yeah." June hadn't had a chance to listen to the radio news that day, but she had seen the headlines and heard folks talking on the bus. The Germans had launched a surprise offensive, and there had been heavy fighting. People had thought the German army was in bad shape, that it was only a matter of time till the Allies made it to Germany, but this meant more bloody fighting. It felt like the war would never end. Cece dug her hands into her coat pockets.
"I used to work in a restaurant in Nashville, and we kept pictures of all the boys from the neighborhood who were overseas, you know, under this big flag. Whenever a boy died, me or one of the other girls had to return his picture to his family. We had to return so many pictures."
Cece started walking again.
"Let's go home. I'm worn out."
They walked silently toward the dorm. It was unusual to spend a quiet moment with Cece. June wondered about her fancy way of talking and dressing. It seemed strange that she'd ever worked in a restaurant. The way Cece went on, June assumed she had come from a well-off family. But if she'd had to work as a waitress, maybe she wasn't as rich as she acted. Cece never did talk about her family or the past, and occasionally she said things that confused June. One of the boys she'd been talking to at a dance a few days before had made a joke about Brutus and Julius Caesar when his friends all got up to dance without him. Cece had clearly not understood what he was talking about. June had read Shakespeare's play in high school and would have thought Cece'd done the same if she went to a fancy Nashville school. Cece had become her best friend, that was for sure, but sometimes June wondered if it hadn't been by default. Cece could be selfish. She ignored June when she was focused on boys, then used June to get their attention when it suited her. She had a habit of laughing at people, which could be cruel, and didn't seem to spend much time considering what it might be like to be less beautiful than she naturally.